Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Jim is also the author of The Weed Agency, due out now in just a couple of weeks. June 3rd is the release date on that. You can pre-order your copies now, and Jim will be very busy in the next couple of weeks, as well as the following weeks, promoting the book, and it's a one I look forward to reading as well. We got good, bad, and crazy martinis for you, as usual, and we have our good martini in the form of a poll today. Politico reporting, Jim, that things are looking even better, somewhat generically for Republicans, but in a little bit of a specialized way. They've basically gone into some of the most highly competitive House race districts, as well as competitive Senate states, and what they're coming away with is people generally preferring the Republican candidate in the House races. It's 39 to 30, and usually in the somewhat of a generic ballot, anywhere close to breaking even is great for Republicans. Now they're up 9 points in that contest. And on the Senate side, generically in the battleground states, it's 43 to 36, a 7-point edge for Republicans. If you break down on the issues, Obamacare is still deeply unpopular. It's more and more of a question of whether folks want a full repeal. Right now, Republicans normally would kill for numbers like this.
We're not used to getting news this good. And I think you kind of put your finger on why this is an important result. You say, look, most of the national polls have looked pretty good for Republicans. But let's face it, Republicans are not likely to do very well in places like California and New York. And they're already expected to do pretty well in places like Texas and Wyoming and arguably Florida. You know, so when you take out the deep red states, the deep blue states, they can really kind of muck up a good sense of where the nation really is, at least where it really matters. And we don't care that much about the deep blue states, the deep red states. We know who's going to win there. We care about these endangered Democrats in red states and maybe the purple states, you know, the Scott Walkers of the world who are winning in states that hadn't been all that friendly to Republicans for a while. One of the things that really jumps out, nearly half say they favor outright repeal of the Affordable Care Act. 60% say the debate's not over, despite the president saying this debate is over. 39% say it is. This jumped out at me. 9 in 10 respondents said the health care law would be important to determining their vote. And 49% said it would be very important. Now, in comparison for immigration reform, which I expect the Democrats will begin beating the drum on pretty recently, only 28% that was very important. Although the, you know, 16% said male-female income disparity. All of this is good stuff in the sense that, look, you know, running against Obamacare is likely to be a winner. We can debate further about whether you need to just say you just want to repeal it or whether you need to have a very, you know, articulate, detailed replacement for it. I also would note, and I just thought it was a great example of sometimes voters can be contradictory in their thinking. They quote Charles Pierre, a retired civil engineer in Virginia's Prince William County, not too far from us, who said his top priority was getting the government back on track where we have a Congress that can get something done. So you're looking at that. Maybe he was upset by the government shutdown. This is a guy who's tired of partisanship, tired of bickering. But then in the very next sentence, Pierre, a self-identified conservative, said he prefers a divided government and deeply distrusts the president. So he wants Congress to get stuff done, but he prefers a divided government. And I hate to tell it to Mr. Pierre, it's not likely to happen because you're going to have two parties that have two fundamentally different ways of looking at the world and what government should do and things like that. But otherwise, this is good news for Republicans who probably need it and kind of confirm our suspicions that while it may not be a great Republican wave from sea to shining sea, Republicans are looking pretty good in most of the places that they have to do well in 2014.
Last Friday, our bad martini was the Veterans Affairs Secretary, Eric Shinseki, telling Congress that he is mad as hell that this happened with the secret lists, veterans having to wait for treatment and several dozen of them dying because of that postponed treatment. Now we find out that there's probably a much broader problem with this across the country. And Obama says he's not just mad, he's even madder than Eric Shinseki, which when you couple that with the resignation of the official who was already about to retire, it kind of reminds you of the president being furious when the IRS scandal broke, forced out the acting commissioner who was going to leave in a week anyway. And I guess, Jim, now it's just a matter of when there's not a smidgen of anything wrong here.
It's not just that he's mad, though, Greg. We're emphasizing he's madder than hell. nobody is more outraged about this program, this problem right now. He's so mad he can't speak to the public himself about it. So I guess if he stepped for the podium, he would just like tear the microphone and smash things and, you know, Barack Obama smash into Hulk-like rage over this, which, by the way, would be an entirely legitimate response to a system that allows dozens and dozens of veterans to die because they're waiting for treatment and then covers it up. This is something that's completely worth getting mad about. We don't hear it from the president. Oftentimes, I think what really outrages you comes from your actions. Obama can say he is, but you get the feeling that he's a lot angrier about, say, Republicans. And, you know, it's not like he's running, you know, putting, you know, hours and hours of effort into going after Shinseki. You know, he apparently declined Shinseki's offer of resignation. At least that's the word that's spreading through Washington. He hasn't fired him. He didn't fire Sebelius after the healthcare.gov debacle. You know, he said how angry he was at AIG bonuses getting into the TARP legislation, but, you know, they still went through. He was really angry at BP, and, you know, BP managed to get a deal. Remember the General Services Administration spending money on luxury hotels in Las Vegas? Oh, nobody was madder than him. You know, and like you feel like we've heard this a million times from him before. Very rarely do we see any type of a consequence to this. And I guess when Obama came into office, he had this philosophy of, well, there's no point in firing somebody just for the sake of firing somebody. By golly, I'm not going to do something empty and symbolic just to do that. Well, one, there's a certain argument that if you do fire somebody when they screw up, you'll have fewer screw-ups down the line because everyone knows that there's a big consequence for screwing up. And, you know, sometimes it's okay for your employees to have a little bit of fear. Maybe not, you know, senseless fear, but a fear that if they make a really big consequential error, that one of the consequences will be they will lose their jobs. People could argue Sebelius, you know, she resigned, but it certainly wasn't a... In fact, Obama went to great lengths to emphasize that he didn't fire her, that she was stepping down voluntarily and her work had been done and all that jazz. So he doesn't seem to think there's any value in firing people. And Greg, I don't know about you, this kind of makes me wish we'd elected somebody who actually enjoys firing people. Enjoys being able to fire people, which I think is a, you know, the president is perfectly able to fire Shinseki or anybody else who's involved, but chooses not to. I guess he kind of feels like, you know, the softer approach will get better results. I think it's safe to say we've now seen the results of this kind of management, and perhaps it's, you know, it's too much carrot, not enough stick, Mr. President. But then again, that applies to your foreign policy as well.
Later today, Media Matters will report that Jim has now endorsed Donald Trump for president, but I'm not sure that was exactly what you were saying there. All right, on to the crazy martini now, Jim. This definitely qualifies. This is from CNN. From responses to natural disasters to a catastrophic attack on the homeland, the U.S. military has a plan of action ready to go if either incident occurs. It has also devised an elaborate plan should a zombie apocalypse befall the country, according to a Defense Department document obtained by CNN. In an unclassified document, officials from U.S. Strategic Command use the specter of a planet-wide attack by the Walking Dead as a training template for how to plan for real-life, large-scale operations, emergencies, and catastrophes. And the Pentagon says there's a reasonable explanation. The document is identified as a training tool used in an in-house training exercise where students learn about the basic concepts of military plans and order development through a fictional training scenario. Jim, there's plenty of horrible things that could happen on a large scale that we could probably prepare for. Pretty sure this one should be pretty far down the list.
Oh, Greg. So naive, you know. When the zombies come, I will turn to you and say, see, I told you so. And aren't you glad the Pentagon has a plan to deal with zombies? Be prepared is the Boy Scout motto. And by golly, that's a good philosophy for the Department of Defense as well. Two thoughts on it. One is that, look, I imagine that the response to marauding zombies would probably be the same as the response to, say, rioters after a major natural disaster or mass cannibalism, or some sort of bioweapon. There's all kinds of prospects. It wouldn't be that dissimilar from the zombie apocalypse scenarios we see in books and TVs and movies and things like that. Greg, I'm sure you recall various, like, you know, civil defense drills and security drills in which no one ever used Islamist terrorists as the perpetrators
right
of their disaster scenario. And I do seem to remember one. So sometimes they would make up groups. And then I remember one school district where they were doing some sort of, like, you know, preparedness drill. And they said it was radical homeschoolers. Really stuck in my craw because, one, if you can find me any example of a radical homeschooling terrorist group in this country, I'll give you a donut. The whole point of homeschoolers is that they want to be left alone. They're not going to come to your school and do terrible things to you. Just, you know, they're part of the Leave Us Alone coalition. It's really kind of an insult. And it kind of is that whole thing when we saw Department of Homeland Security saying that if you have a Gadsden flag on your bumper stick, you know, it could be a sign you're a militia member and things like that. This whole notion of, you know, mainstream border, you know, grassroots conservative politics being a leading indicator of being a dangerous member of a right-wing militia was one, a terrible smear; two, a spectacularly wrong-headed approach to security issues; three, quite clearly a guilt by association way to try to tarnish conservatives and those sorts of things. So the Department of Defense has avoided all that and kind of contended that, you know, the threat to our homeland will not come from Timothy McVeigh types or even, you know, run-of-the-mill conservatives that the administration has decided to demonize. It will come from zombies. And thankfully, as far as I know, there is not a decaying American community association arguing the Pentagon has unfairly smeared them and is discriminating against them in this category. Do you know what it really took to come up with a plan like this at the Pentagon, Greg?
Not a clue.
Brains. Go forth and prosper, Pentagon. I think this is a fine choice.
True. They could have said it was conservative zombies. So, yeah, we're not the target this time.
Space aliens. And I'm sure the skills you develop in that kind of a drill are applicable to a whole bunch of situations. I imagine there are very few zombie-specific domestic security initiatives Pentagon would do.
Let's hope not. We got $17 trillion in debt. If we're going to add to it, zombies would be pretty hard to pallet. All right, Jim, on that note, have a fabulous day. Hopefully the zombies don't attack before tomorrow's edition of the Three Martini Lunch. I'll talk to you then.
See you tomorrow, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. Please join us on Tuesday for the next Three Martini Lunch.